Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
And good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Let me again here a little bit more completely introduce the two guests we have in the studio for this first hour of the show. P. Patrick Leahy is the acting director of the U.S. Geological Survey and has had that job now for a while. He has degrees from Boston College and from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. He's got a doctorate in geology from there, where he specialized in regional groundwater studies and hydraulics. He has been with the survey since 1974 and has served in various positions, including chief of the National Water Quality Assessment Program. Also here with us in the studio is William Schiltz. He is the chief of the Illinois State Geological Survey, has been since June of 1995. He has his degrees from DePauw University, has a PhD in geology from Syracuse University in Syracuse, New York. Before taking over as chief of the state survey, he worked for 30 years as a research scientist for the Geological Survey of Canada, leading studies in the fields of glacial geology, environmental geochemistry, mineral exploration, and the impacts of earthquakes. Dr. Leahy is here to talk as part of a series that has been going on now to mark the centennial of the state Geological Survey. They've been in business here for 100 years. And in fact, he'll be giving a talk along with Scott Tinker, who's director of the Texas Bureau of Economic Geology. And he, by the way, will be here tomorrow morning. We could talk about some things with him as well. But the two of them, Dr. Leahy, Dr. Tinker, will be talking about the role of science in policymaking this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Beckman Institute Auditorium. It is free and open to the public, so anybody who's interested should feel welcome to stop by. And here this morning on the program, people who are listening, you have questions, you certainly should feel welcome to call in. 333-945 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That means no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. And then for local folks, it is 333-9455. At any point here, you have questions, you can give us a call. Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you, David.
A point I thought it would be interesting to start with maybe, and that would be to for Dr. Leahy to talk a little bit about what happened back in, I believe this was in 1995, when there were some people in the Congress, apparently, who felt that the United States didn't need the Geological Survey anymore and decided we could just line that one out, be a good way to save some money. And I guess fortunately, the survey had enough friends that they managed to persuade the Congress that that would be a bad idea and that the survey provided some important services to the United States. But that, I suppose, gives the opportunity to raise this question. Well, you know, we have state geological surveys. We have universities that do this kind of similar kinds of work. Right. We have private industry that does the same. So why do we need to have a federal earth science agency?
Right. David, I think 95 was perhaps even a broader event than the U.S. Geological Survey. I think, and I've heard people state that perhaps even our name is not appropriate. Surveys have an endpoint. And what we're talking here is developing a knowledge and information base that serves society well into the future. Certainly, resource needs, groundwater availability, natural hazards, concern about the environment, those issues are not going away. In fact, they probably are getting more complex, so that we need a body of information that really assists the policymaker in terms of informing some of the difficult decisions they're faced with in terms of management of our public domain. The other thing I would add in terms of this is we work very closely with the state geological surveys, with academia and with industry. And that combination is really what I would characterize as the earth science community, earth and natural science community, that really working together is providing the body of information that the nation needs. Mm-hmm. And you can't have one without the other. I think in terms of a federal survey, our role is quite important in terms of when I look at it, we basically provide what I would characterize as four things. Long-term insightful monitoring, our earthquake network, our stream gauge network may be very, very good examples of that. We do interpretive studies or assessments using that body of information so that it's used to solve problems that society cares about. Is there enough groundwater for the future in this particular basin? Is the water quality of our nation's streams getting better or worse? Those types of questions. And, of course, the third element is having some basic research so that your understanding of processes is improving. And, of course, that helps you in terms of monitoring the right things at the right times in the right ways, as well as putting that knowledge into the interpretive work we do. The fourth element, and this really gets back to the focus of the conference today and also back to the issue in 1995. It's not enough to do all those things. The fourth piece is information delivery. We need to get this information to the policymaker and to the general public, and it needs to have impact in terms of the decision making and in the awareness of those individual groups.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll turn real quick to Bill Shields. If the U.S. Geological Survey didn't exist, wouldn't there not be someone? State surveys, private business, the various earth scientists who are in colleges and universities across the country, wouldn't there be somebody who would do this work, who would pick up the slack and who could perform these functions that Dr. Leahy just lined out?
Well, that's a difficult question. One of the things that the USGS does, it provides a national focus that goes beyond state boundaries. It acts sort of like a glue to coordinate earth science programs. For instance, there's a national geologic mapping program that the states all tap into, but that's overseen by the U.S. Geological Survey to assure standards are comparable from state to state. And there is, like all fields that are related to political boundaries, there's a certain amount of geological chauvinism among the states where we have had to deal with that in our mapping program in the Midwest. And the Geological Survey, U.S. Geological Survey, has been a partner. And I think that partnership has helped us overcome some of this, what we like to call in geology, state line faults. The geology on the Indiana side comes to the Illinois state line, and it changes because either the scale that we're doing things at is different or we see the geology differently. And this enterprise that I believe I talked to you about a couple of years ago has really evolved into sort of a seamless activity among the four states, but a lot, the glue and the organization of that has been the USGS. And I think that type of activity on a national scale is their strength.
Yeah. Well, just let me ask you one other question just at this point, and then we'll go on and we can talk with our caller. The kinds of science that both of you and both of your surveys are involved in are very basic, and I think that you could certainly argue that they were important, things like water supply and quality, things like acid rain, things like trying to assess the potential for earthquake, just to name three things, and there are a lot of other things. At the same time, the kind of science that now seems to get an awful lot of attention, it's getting a lot of funding, get a lot of attention in the media, things like genetics, other kinds of electrical engineering that has to do with computers and so forth, the whole digital world. The physical sciences are not really very sexy. These other things certainly are and draw money just like a magnet. Are you and do the physical sciences, these kinds of really basic sorts of things we're talking about, are you having any difficulty in getting the funding to do this kinds of very basic research?
Well, I think there's a couple issues here that I think are important. First of all, I think you need to recognize that the U.S. Geological Survey, much like our state geological surveys, are really mission-oriented organizations. Mm-hmm. We're a part of the Department of the Interior, and certainly the mission of the Department of Interior is to manage the lands of the United States, the federal lands specifically, that are under their purview. So clearly we need to produce the science that will help the department do that effectively. I do think that we have used modern techniques. The whole notion of computer modeling is now thoroughly ingrained in terms of the earth sciences, the use of GIS. We have a biological component, so things like the genetics is particularly important for us in terms of understanding species and their populations and so forth. The use of the Internet, that is a critical delivery mechanism for our information. So although we're not developing those techniques per se, they have become a greater part of our scientific life as tools. You know, priorities are difficult. There are lots of priorities out there. And, of course, events generally drive those. For example, the tsunami of last December 26th, or a year or so ago, really increased the concern of the nation in terms of the vulnerability of the U.S. to earthquake-generated tsunamis, particularly in the Caribbean, and the ability to deliver information quicker and new innovative products. So again, those events have helped in terms of highlighting the importance of certain elements of our budget.
Well, why don't we get call here getting this call from this listener. He's been very patient with us, someone who's listening this morning in Urbana on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I hope I don't interrupt with what amounts to a practical sort of question to understand the work of geological surveys. When I first came to Illinois, the interstates were still being constructed in this region. And as I would drive one way or another, there were a large number of almost rectangular lakes that paralleled the interstates on private property. And people had gotten boats in them or docks or whatever they felt like. And I remember being told, I'm sorry, I don't know by whom, that those were regions along the sides of the interstate where gravel was known to be underground at certain depths, and that gravel, rock, stone, sand, whatever they needed, was used in the construction of the interstate highways, that it was just easier and cheaper to mine them on the site than to haul them in long distances. Did the state of Illinois survey have anything to do with finding where those gravel pits were, or was that part of the process of building an interstate highway?
Well, can you answer that?
I can partially answer that. I wasn't here when the interstates were being built, but those rectangular pits are really there for fill. The site of the interstates was chosen regardless of where gravel was. Most of them are not in gravel. They're in what is called glacial till, which is a clay, stony material. And you'll notice that wherever there's an overpass, wherever the interstates rise, there are these square pits. So basically what they did is take material out of the ground beside the interstate and use it to build up the overpasses. The gravel they used, if it did occur next to the interstate, would have been fortuitous. The route was not chosen because of where the gravel was. Gravel certainly was used in the production of cement.
It made for an interesting story, but I guess the truth is always a little more mundane. The question that followed whenever I heard that or something like that was, what was the pattern of survey that the Illinois Natural History Survey or the Geological Survey undertook? Did you deliberately go so and so many miles in every direction and sink a hole and see what was underneath? Or was it a more selective pattern, knowing what the surface was like? Did you deliberately follow contours and terrains to see what was underneath? How was that survey actually set up? A big grid or another way of deciding where to drill and how deep to drill, too, to find out what was under the ground?
Well, I think the general maps that the survey has made over the years of the distribution of the deposits of the glaciers that covered Illinois were probably used by contractors to determine where they would use gravel, and naturally they would try to pick areas of gravel that were closest to where the interstates were, but the path of the interstates was determined without reference to where the gravel was. I'll have to say that in my early career, I worked for the state of Vermont, and I didn't realize it at the time because I was just freshly into graduate school, but I realized later on that a lot of the large gravel pits in Vermont were developed to support their interstate system, and their interstate system, because of the topography, was much more controlled by geology, and I didn't realize it at the time, but when we were mapping geology there, it was to help locate the best routes for the interstate system, both from supplying gravel and negotiating the most favorable terrain.
Mm. So decade by decade, the work that any survey does depends on what is the most pressing need at the time.
Yes, that's a very good point, and that's definitely true.
Well, thank you for the chance to talk.
All right. Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So let's say, for example, the state survey, if the state of Illinois has some pressing sort of question that falls into your area that needs to be answered, does then government come to the survey and say, okay, here we got a problem. We need you to figure this out for us. And in what sense is your activity and your agenda set by scientists at the survey who think these are interesting problems, these are important problems, we're going to work on them, or that you're somehow directed by government, I don't know, by the governor, by the legislature, by somebody who says, well, here we have a critical issue here. We need some data. We need to have a better understanding of this. That's what you guys do. You go out and you do the study, and then you come back and you can tell us what you found.
Well, I would say both. Often we have problems brought to us. For instance, when the confined feedlots hit Illinois about the time I arrived here, there was emergency legislation developed to avoid pollution associated mm-hmm. with these high concentrations of waste. And at that time, we were approached to help draft the legislation, the emergency legislation, and in fact, maps that we had made on aquifer sensitivity were used for that. One of the main reasons that one of the main functions of these geological surveys, whether it's the USGS or the ISGS or surveys in the other 49 states, all of which have one, is to be proactive. In other words, we try to have our researchers look at research problems in the state that are likely to impact society in the near or long term, so that when, for instance, the discussion about an airport at Piatone, one of the first things I did when I came here and heard that that was going to be an issue, and that was some years ago, I had one of our researchers do a project to map the footprint of what was thought to be the location of that airport at the time. And now those maps are, as the discussions get more serious, those maps are quite valuable. But we try to stay ahead of the curve.
Yeah. I would just echo Bill's comment that it's really you really have to look at both. And let me cite a couple of examples mm-hmm. that give a bit of a national perspective. Approximately a year or so ago, we were all sort of in awe when we had the rovers on Mars. And one of the big questions associated with that exploration, of course, was the search for water. Well, one way you can determine water is to look at the rocks. Are these fluvial deposits? Are they put down by wind? The USGS was asked to provide technical support, and we have since the beginning of the space program, in terms of that geologic insight. We had a team of scientists that clearly were working with JPL and NASA in terms of do these rocks reflect the presence of water at some time in Mars' past? That's something of a mandate. Let me give you another that's even a little bit more broader in terms of global issues. We have been working with our State Department, AID, other government agencies, and with the government of Afghanistan in terms of rebuilding an economy over there. Clearly, some of the capabilities the USGS has can be brought to bear in terms of oil and gas resources, water resources issues, even seismic risk in the area. So, again, having that technical assistance almost mandated to us really puts sort of the upper level demands on the system. On the other hand, working very closely with the state surveys, who are very close to where some of the real practical down-home kind of problems are, extremely important. This cooperative effort, this consortium that we're involved with out here, with the state of Illinois as well as adjacent states, to look at the geologic frameworks in three dimensions associated with those glacial deposits, is a very practical but challenging scientific problem that, again, brings together a body of capabilities that really are up to the task of tackling this problem so that the information can be used for water availability, groundwater protection, where aggregate may be found for future roads or construction to drive the economy.
We'll continue talking with our guest here in a moment, and we'll get on to another call. For anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I would again like to introduce the guests. We have here in studio with us Patrick Leahy. He's acting director of the U.S. Geological Survey. He's been with the survey since 1974, has served in various technical and managerial positions, including chief of the National Water Quality Assessment Program. He is here visiting the campus and will be talking along with Scott Tinker, director of the Texas Bureau of Economic Geology, this afternoon, talking about the role of science in policymaking. And their talk will be at 4 o'clock in the Beckman Institute Auditorium. It's free and open to the public. It's part of a series that is going on now to mark the centennial of the Illinois State Geological Survey. And also here in the studio with me is Bill Schultz. He is the chief of the Illinois State Geological Survey, has been the chief since June of 95. Before taking over as chief, he worked for 30 years as a research scientist for the Geological Survey of Canada. We have somebody who's waiting to talk with us. Let's do that. I will not make them wait longer. A caller in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hi. This is a big picture comment. And I'm going to tie in space, geology, and PBS. I mean, NPR and PBS.
That is a big picture.
Yeah, And the war in Iraq. How about that? And tax cuts. Maybe you can see where I'm heading here. We happen to have a geologist in the family. I have a brother who works for a geological survey in another state. And we have a family rocket scientist who works for a private big aerospace company. And I care deeply about PBS and NPR, as people might know, because I call in so often. And I was talking with a rocket scientist last night and asking him how they were faring with all these ups and downs with funding changes. And he says it's very frustrating because, you put in, there are requests for proposals go out, and then there isn't the funding for them. So the private company ends up saying, why are we putting all this money into having rocket scientists on our staff? And if we aren't actually generating any income because government funds keep getting cut, how do we plan for these things? Seems to me the same thing is happening with geology. My brother was saying that there was difficulty finding geologists to head up coal research. And it seems like there's a shift back in the direction of coal because of the price of gas going up. What I'm leading toward saying is, in our governments and political parties' efforts to cut what they see as easy targets in terms of funding, we're jeopardizing our bank of knowledgeable scientists and specialists because the job prospects are so uncertain. It takes a long time to train a geologist. It takes a long time to train somebody in aerospace things. And how can you put your future on the line if you see such lack of commitment to these things and to having some slop in the system because you don't know where we're going in 10, 15, 20 years in the future? And I'm seeing, in the paper recently there were all the cuts that were happening because of huge deficits, which are being caused by the war in Iraq, and because our Republican government keeps wanting to cut taxes. I really think we need to, as citizens, we need to stand up and say our freedoms are being jeopardized because we're cutting resources to the to NPR and PBS that helped give us more in-depth information. We're cutting our resources to the scientists that give us the background that we need. It seems to me that our whole society is being affected by this whole war and combined with tax cuts, and I think we all need to stand up and say, hey, it's affecting all. And I just begun to scratch the surface. I haven't talked about social programs, but you get the picture.
Sure.
And I extend you my sympathies, and I'm sending out a sort of a heads up and a red flag to all the listeners out there. You know, I think our society and our country is deeply in danger because of the way that, because of this war, and because of the way that we're continuing to cut taxes, particularly for people who can afford to pay more. So thanks very much. I don't know what you can possibly say to that.
We'll give the guest the opportunity. You can respond in any way that you like.
I'll answer the question a little bit. Obviously, there's some political perspectives there that I won't touch. But I do want to point out that setting priorities is always challenging. Our policymakers are really faced with a daunting task of picking one versus another. And there are competing interests there. There's no question about it. And there are never enough resources to basically do it all. So you have to be smart. Certainly from an earth science perspective, we recognize the challenge here. And forums like today in terms of the earth sciences and its role in public policy are absolutely critical in terms of informing the public and informing the policymakers of the importance of our science. Without that information, I think we're just one of many, many requests that may or may not have merit. So again, I think that's why that's important. The other issue I want to point out is something that I think people are calling the quiet crisis in America. And basically what that is our science and technology people are getting towards retirement age. The baby boomer generation is starting to retire. And as a result, the pipeline is getting a bit thinner. And the question that we're all struggling with, particularly in the federal government, is what will the workforce of the future look like? It is clear to me that we will see more leveraging of federal resources. We will see more partnerships in the future where we will go out and seek skills from academia, from the state government, to work together to get the most out of it. It's not a matter of the resource will not be there in terms of the human power we need to get the job done. So I think we're seeing an effort to start to come up with creative ideas in terms of dealing with that issue.
Let me ask you another question, which you probably won't want to touch either. Given that the talk that you're going to do with Dr. Tinker, the title is The Role of Science in Policymaking, it seems to me that we are at a time here where politics and science are clashing to the extent that greater than they ever have before. Now, that may indeed not be true. I mean, there may always have been a way in which politics and science have clashed. But it seems that, and this administration particularly, has been criticized for allowing its political agenda to direct science. They have been accused of, for example, if the scientists go out and they research a particular topic and they come back and it has something in there the administration doesn't like, then it is said that the administration will say, well, look, can you just kind of tone this down here because we really don't like that conclusion. And scientists, I think, have complained that they're doing their work and they're reporting on the way that they see things. And that if people in power, and it could be in the White House, it could be in Congress, it could be in a state legislature, if they don't like the conclusions, if it doesn't fit with, if it's not what they want, they'll ignore it, they'll bury it, they'll ask for parts of it to be rewritten, they'll ask for things to be excised, which frustrates the scientists no end, because they're doing their work, and I think they would like to think that they're doing it in a straightforward and unbiased way. Science is science, you know? Either you got the data or you don't, and you don't fudge it and you don't shape it to fit the way you would like things to be. Do you think that that is any more true now, that politics and politicians put pressure on science to get it to bend in the ways that they would like it to?
I guess I would answer that question with three elements, and then I'll turn it over to Bob. I think the peer review process is a critical way of maintaining the integrity of the science. There's no question that the peer review process is really a vehicle that has been used very effectively in terms of ensuring the quality of the science. However, I do think that there's some issues that, as earth scientists, we have been remiss in. One is characterizing the notion of uncertainty. We tend to put out publications that in many instances tend to be black and white. And I think society looks for those. They don't want a maybe. They want a yes or a no. I think in terms of the weather community, publications come out they make forecasts in terms of it may rain tomorrow and there's a 10% probability or whatever. People understand that and they basically resolve their lives around it. But in many other scientific debates, we do not cast that uncertainty effective enough so that the public and the policymakers understand the relative certainty in terms of the findings. And I think that's an area that, from a scientific point of view, we absolutely have to improve in. The third element is, I would say, bridging the science to the impact. We are not policymakers by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, my own agency has no regulatory responsibilities whatsoever, and I think yours doesn't either, Bill, which really makes us an honest broker of information, which I think is a very valuable place to be in terms of serving all needs. But we have not done a terribly effective job in terms of coming up with products that really bridge that gap to the policymaker well enough so that it's clear, understandable, and usable immediately. And that's an area that, again, I think is absolutely critical in terms of some of the issues you raised.
Do you want to add anything to that?
Well, excuse me. There are probably a lot of things to add. I'm trying to think of a way to do this shortly. Science, as Pat points out, there are a lot of and by the way, I'm Bill. You're seeing Bob in a few minutes.
excuse me.
Science, particularly earth science, has a lot of uncertainties. When you think of maps, for instance, and I just got back from a week in Washington trying to explain the mapping program that we're trying to generate money for. And when you talk about geologic maps, often people who don't have a geology background think of topographic maps, which are really technical products. An elevation on the land, unless somebody digs it out, an elevation on the land today is the same as it's going to be 10 years from now or 100 years from now. Whereas geologic maps, there's a lot of guesswork involved in going, especially when you're trying to visualize the subsurface. And I find that it's a challenge for people like Pat and myself to try to get these very difficult concepts across to a population when you're speaking about earth science. A population is probably less than 5% of the population has ever had any formal training at the high school level or college level in earth science. So you're talking to people, geologists are used to talking to people who are starting from square one. And so it's a real challenge to get those ideas across, and it's only by getting those ideas across effectively that earth science is put in the priority queue in the place that it belongs. The caller earlier, and you were implying that there are huge amounts of money that go to other priorities. Well, those are national priorities. We provide, as Pat says, objective information to people who are making decisions, but we are not in the position of setting policy or making decisions ourselves. All we can do is provide it in the most effective way we can, the best science we can, and then present it to them in the most effective way so that they can make their own decisions. Right. But it's really not up to these organizations to determine whether this is whether we're well enough funded or not. We just do what we can to get unbiased science to the public.
Well, that's going back to this question, though. I mean, do you think that it is the case that government is getting in the way of bringing unbiased science to the public? Because government has biases. I mean, it has political biases. Any government has a particular worldview, has a particular agenda. You know, there's a way that they see things.
I don't think they necessarily get in the way. I think it's a case of just not being aware of the value of what we do sometimes, and a lot of times that's our fault for not being able to explain it well enough. And earth science is changing. I'm sure Pat will talk about that this afternoon to include people who are much better at expressing the science in a way that society can use it.
Well, and that's I would be also the first to admit that media does not always do a very good job of reporting on science. It's difficult. If you were a reporter and you're covering some scientific subject, if you don't have a background in that, it can be sometimes difficult. And then if you get a scientist who's not real good at explaining things to you in a way that you as a non-scientist can understand, you know, that it can be difficult. So I think there's a real big gap within the world of journalism and in science reporting. We could certainly use a lot more and better science reporters. Well, I'll tell you what, we have several callers here and probably not enough time to get them all in. We'll see if we can get some of them, starting with a caller in Belgium. That's over by Danville, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir. I'm a bit confused about the topic today because I started listening and talking about hydrology, which is a question that I really wanted to ask about. But then now we're talking about reports about how the administration or any administration kind of perceives how they're going to handle any report, which I have many questions about that too. But about the hydrology, and the gentleman just spoke about geological mapping of hydrology. Has anybody ever done any studies about what we push into the earth or what we pull out of the earth as far as hydrology goes? I used to work at a large paper mill that was located on the Wabash River. And this was 20 years ago, and at that time they were taking several millions of gallons a day out of the aquifer, turning it into paper, dumping it in the river, and away it went. And I live in an area now where it's fairly close to a place where, for years, a company would force stuff into it, material that was the byproducts of generating freon. Genetron is the actual compound they made. And they pumped very nasty things down into the earth. It seems to me like we've got a real problem there. We're sucking the water out to drink or use, but yet at the same time we're putting contaminants in to get rid of. Does anybody ever map that kind of stuff?
Well, that's one of the major things we do at the Geological Survey in Illinois is trying to – that's the point of doing the three-dimensional mapping that we're talking about earlier is to try to ensure that any activity, any industrial activity or activity such as you described that take place are taking place in a place where the groundwater supplies are protected. In fact, we do a lot of research on actually modeling how pesticides are how they penetrate the ground and making sure that we understand the types of terrain that will be appropriate for disposing of pesticides or even for farming for that matter.
Yeah.
Pat from the USGS is probably better qualified to talk about that because he was director of the National Water Quality Program at one point in his career.
Yeah, because this material is injected into the ground at 800 feet below the surface. Well, they say, oh, it's trapped in the rocks down there. But yet the same wells that I had actual activity with, I had to test the water from, they were like 700 or 800 feet in the ground too. Seems to me like we're just asking for trouble. I mean, it's just what could possibly be more stupid to do than to do that? And these places were maybe 35 or 40 miles apart, so, okay, you know, we're not talking side by side. But, you know, you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. I think one of the key things here is this is where interpretive studies are absolutely critical in terms of understanding these hydrologic systems and how they behave. That means having a good database so that you understand if those areas are very, very similar or if they're quite different and behave differently in terms of injection versus withdrawals. It's the type of study that I think the USGS, the states, really work together in a regional context. Now, in terms of the individual of a behavior of a well field or so forth, that generally falls into the consulting community to do it. But they will use that regional context that the state survey and federal survey will provide.
Well, is water, are there laws that control the water underneath the ground? Because it seems though if you pump the water out in Champagne by a gazillion gallons a day, that's going to affect somebody that's farther away on the Mohammed Aquifer. It might be on a small arm of it to where they might not get as much water. It happens out in the Ogallala water aquifers where some people are in the bowl and they lose water because somebody in the middle is sucking it out. It seems to me there ought to be some laws about this. Or are there?
Well, that there is another survey here on the campus that specializes in water issues. It's the Illinois State Water Survey. And actually, this is the kind of thing we have talked about on and off with the guy who runs Derek Winstanley, who is the head of the water survey, something that is receiving, I think, increasing attention because the burden on water supplies, groundwater particular, has increased dramatically. And here, for example, in this part of the state, there are a growing number of people who are drawing on the water supply. Now, maybe I shouldn't say this because it's not my area of expertise, but I think that is it not the case that, in fact, in deciding who can draw on the water, that it's, in a sense, it's up to all of those people to kind of work that out for themselves? There really isn't a law that says who can have the water and how much they can have. So it has to be a process of everyone who uses the resource, hopefully managing it in a way that benefits everyone who uses the resource. Have I pretty much got that right?
Yeah, I think you do. Where this is beginning to be critical is in the area around Chicago, where different towns will be drawing water from the same aquifer, and they're beginning at a county level to try to coordinate that to do just what you say, David, to try to keep one city or one new development or 12,000 home developments going up there without too much regard to what impact that's going to have on neighboring aquifers. And one of the things we're trying to do with the resources we have is to provide the counties and the municipalities up there with the sort of subsurface information, the water survey, the U.S. Geological Survey's water science center here in Champaign are all trying to do this, and we work together a lot on these problems, trying to develop models that the folks at the county and municipal level can use to help cooperate, as you say, David, and deal with this issue.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. I'm sure that one of the things that we have done here the last couple of years, generally in the summertime, we've had Derek Winstanley on this program to do a general kind of conversation about water issues in this part of the state. I'm sure we will do that again this year. And one of the things that we spent a lot of time talking about was this very issue of how do governmental units, other various interests that all maybe have some claim to stake on the water supply. How do you work this out, to make sure that everybody gets what they need, but you continue to protect that resource for all of the future people who are going to put demands on that resource? So I know it's something that he's been very much involved in some years now.
I might say that this state is unusual in the fact that we do have a water survey. There is no other state that has one. All of them have geological surveys, and we both have water responsibilities because of the geologic nature of it. The geological survey basically deals with the vessel that the water is in, the aquifers, and the nature, their physical nature, and the water survey tends to deal with the water. And the U.S. Geological Survey, who have a large office here also, deal with both aspects and work with both of us very closely.
Yeah. Well, I'm at the point here where we're going to have to stop, and I must apologize. We have some callers that we can't take. However, first of all, I want to mention again that our guest, Patrick Leahy, will be speaking along with Scott Tinker, who is director of the Texas Bureau of Economic Geology. They'll be talking about this subject of science and policymaking this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Beckman Institute Auditorium, free and open to the public. This is, again, as I mentioned, part of a series of lectures going on to mark the centennial of the Illinois State Water Survey.